here on FM. We continue our Book of the Week selection from Susanna Hislop's Stories in the Stars, a seasonal reading for clear and frosty nights where the skies sparkle with thousands of dots, forming half-remembered, almost traceable shapes that tell the stories of the people they were named after and the myths that live on in the most unlikely constellations. We begin with the author's own recollections of her first encounters with a celestial giant.
Orion, the Hunter. The days draw in. The pumpkins and the fireworks come out, and the giant hunter Orion appears in the sky, his dogs Canis Major and Canis Minor snapping at his heels. Or at least, he's supposed to. Perhaps as a child I was too busy sparkling my name in the air to notice the glittering of the great hero's belt. In days of old, mothers sang lullabies to their children to pass on their knowledge of the stars. I wish that one of my many babysitters had told me about the stellar nursery hidden just south of this huntsman's belt, the Orion Nebula, in which not just stars, but whole solar systems are formed. Or about Shen, the warrior, who the Chinese also see in these stars as part of a celestial hunting tableau. Why, when I wrote a whole project on Inuits, did I not learn that they too saw hunters chasing through the night? Why did my New Zealand au pair not tell me about the canoe of Tamariretti, the mythical ancestor of the Maori people? Or my Norwegian nanny not thrill me with tales of Thor breaking off Aurvandil's frozen toe and casting it up into the heavens? Only in adulthood have I learnt that this star-spangled hunter is the descendant of the great Sumerian hero Uru-Anna, meaning light of heaven, who fought the bull of heaven and whom we call Gilgamesh, and that this is why Orion is still pictured brandishing his club and lion pelt against the charging Taurus.
Taurus, the bull. Two bovine tails of lust ignite the bright-starred horns of Taurus. Both, you will not be surprised to hear, involve the libidinous Zeus. The first is of Io, yet another of the gods' flings flung aside to a life of suffering and misery. The story starts much as they all do. Once upon a time, there was a beautiful girl, and Zeus fell in love with her and, to use the euphemism the ancients seemed so fond of, ravished the innocent virgin. When the god's wife Hera challenged her adulterous husband, he lied to her face. "I did not so much as touch the girl," he said brazenly, though not quite able to look at her straight. Hoping to protect young Io, who still softened his capricious heart, Zeus turned her into a cow. But Hera claimed the heifer as hers and sent the hundred-eyed guardsman Argus to spy on her. Not one to be trumped in marital guile, Zeus sent Hermes to steal her back. Charming Argus asleep with the soft sounds of a flute, Hermes cut off his head and freed poor, lowing Io. In revenge, Hera sent a gadfly to chase, bite, buzz, and plague Io wherever she went, while Argus's hundreds of eyes she placed forever in a peacock's feathers. The second is The Rape of Europa, a bovine tale in reverse. For when Zeus was not turning his paramours into heifers, he was disguising himself as a bull. Europa was another young and lovely thing, the daughter of King Agenor of Phoenicia. Zeus looked down on this princess lasciviously, or perhaps in this case, his heart was tender and true. As she played on the beach with her friends, her delicate ankles frolicking in the surf. Employing the wiles of his trickster son Hermes once again, Zeus devised a cunning plan. King Agenor had a herd of fine cattle, and getting Hermes to drive them from their mountain pastures to the seashore, Zeus took his place amongst the line of cows plodding their way down the hillside. Europa turned from the waves to see a beautiful white bull staring up at her, batting thick lashes across its big brown eyes. She stroked its back and let it lick her palm and put flowers in its horns. Then, climbing up onto its back, she let it carry her down to the shore. But when it reached the water, it didn't stop, and soon it was swimming with her out to sea. Europa's friends stood in horror as the bull diminished towards the horizon, carrying the princess to Crete and leaving a trail of flowers on the waves.
Ara, the altar. In the creamy depths of the Milky Way lies an altar of stars. It's not that easy to spot and has little to distinguish itself in the way of exciting astronomical phenomena. Yet this small constellation, so seemingly insignificant that no one has even named any of its stars, has been recognised and worshipped for thousands of years. Long ago, when Iraq was part of Mesopotamia, the legend went that offerings were burnt on this celestial altar to thank the gods for saving King Utnapishtim, the ancestor of the great hero Gilgamesh. Utnapishtim was the wise king and priest of Shurippak, a city on the banks of the river Euphrates. The city was as old as time and full of gods, who one day got it into their heads to besiege the city with a flood. So Enki, the god of mischief, craft, seawater and creation, went to Utnapishtim and told him that he must build a giant ship to escape the deluge. Utnapishtim bent down on his knees and Enki sketched out a plan of the ship before him in the sand. It was vast, as long as it was wide and tall, and 7 floors high. Utnapishtim sent for the craftsmen of Shurippak, and they set to work as fast as their fear. Utnapishtim plied his men with ale and wine, and at sunset on the 7th day they finished the ark. Seeing the skies beginning to turn, the king gathered together everything he could, his kith and his kin, his livestock and grain, his silver, gold, and all his loyal craftsmen, and squeezed every last being into the teeming ark. He sealed up its doors with clay, ready to set sail. The storm hit, and the land was turned to water. The ship heaved and groaned like a woman in the agonies of labour, and even the gods retreated from the flood in fear. After 12 baleful days, the storm subsided, and Utnapishtim opened the hatch of the ark. He saw that it was balancing on the slopes of Mount Nimush, and that his world and all that he had known had been swallowed by elemental rage, a rage so fierce that the brushes of modern archaeologists have revealed its scars in the dust. After 7 days, Utnapishtim sent forth a dove. When the dove returned, he sent forth a swallow. When the swallow returned, he sent a raven, and when the raven never came back, he knew that there was at last some dry land, and so he opened the doors of the ark and set all that was in it free. In return for his piety and for saving the human race, the gods granted him immortality and a place in the heavens. And the celestial smoke that burns from the altar, Ara, in his honour, is the haze of the Milky Way.
Chameleon. It was not a year too soon when I was finally honored in the stars. I had spent millennia shifting about the night, lighting up as a Chinese tortoise here, a Navajo coyote there. I was particularly good as a Borong Malafowl, if I do say so myself. Indeed, before those kindly Dutch cartographers gave me my own place in the celestial sphere, I had been treated really rather badly by your kind. It was that big-nosed Roman meddler of yours, Ovid, who started it all, as he did so many mistruths. Once Publius Ovidius Naso had waxed lyrical about my eating air and changing color, they were all at it. I can't deny that I enjoy the attention. As Oscar Wilde, whose capricious nature I, of course, admire, once said, "There's only one thing in the world worse than being talked about, and that is not being talked about." But did old Will need to be quite so obscure when getting that inky adolescent Hamlet to use me as a metaphor? King Claudius. How fares our cousin Hamlet? Hamlet. Excellent, i'faith. Of the chameleon's dish, I eat the air, promise crammed. You cannot feed capons so. I have had centuries to ponder the words the young prince spits out at his usurping uncle and still have no idea whether I'm getting a good write-up or not. Then there was that tubercular teenager, Keats, co-opting me as one of his tribe. What shocks the virtuous philosopher delights the chameleon poet. Fair enough. I have scant regard for the opinion of your moral philosophers, but I am not sure I hold your brain bards in any higher esteem. I was most hurt by that young romantic's insinuation that I have no identity to call my own. It has no self. It is everything and nothing. It has no character. It enjoys light and shade. It lives in gusto, be it foul or fair, high or low, rich or poor, mean or elevated. As those worthy explorers, Kieser and de Houtman, discovered when they landed in Madagascar in 1595, my ability to camouflage myself in hostile environments is proof of my idiosyncratic skill, my peculiar singularity, not my clone-like inconsequence. Perhaps you humans should look to yourselves, shuffling around your offices in your gray suits before you cast aspersions on my imaginative flair. And while I'm at it, I do not appreciate the moniker you Australians use to describe me. I am most certainly not, and never have been, something as drab and domestic as a frying pan.
Susanna Hislop introduced the second selection of extracts from her book Stories in the Stars. The other readers were Noma Dumez-Swanee, Paul Copley and Coleman Domingo. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters. It's a Waters Company production, and our Book of the Week continues tomorrow.
On BBC Radio 4, Good Omens by Sir Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman.
So, what's up?
This is...
Oh. No.
Yes.
Dramatised for radio for the first time.
It's me, Aziraphale.
Crowley!
I took a baby to a hospital last night.
The Antichrist?
Mm-hmm.
Already?
Yes.
Why didn't you tell me? What about the arrangement?
I didn't have time.
Really?
Good Omens, starring Peter Serafinowicz and Mark Heap, continues tonight at 11:30 and then on the Radio 4 website.
How do you feel about wearing leather? What about pleather, the artificial alternative? Woman's Hour, we'll be getting into that in a couple of minutes.